Okay, so last time we gave a definition of what unramified endoscopic groups are. So, it's called G is a reductive group, and it is assumed to be unramified, which means to split over an unramified extension and to be quasi-split. And such groups were classified by it's called root data, consisting of characters, co-characters, roots, co-roots, and an automorphism of finite order preserving the data. And the unramified endoscopic groups were not defined just by taking some sort of subgroup of the original group, but you take a subset of the defining data for the group with a certain compatibility on this automorphism of finite order. So the first two elements were exactly the same as before. But this was to be just a subset of the set of co-roots. Now, I want to look at Cartan subgroups inside both of these groups as well. In these cases, I've restricted so that the groups are unramified. But when I start to look at Cartan subgroups, I want to allow the Cartan subgroups to split not just over an unramified extension, but over an arbitrary extension. So T, let's say, is a torus, and it's a reductive group, so it's going to be classified in a similar sort of way, except in the case of a torus, there are no roots or co-roots to take into account. And if I allow the torus to split over a more general extension, I'm going to have something a little more complicated here in the last slot. I'm going to let F1 over F be a splitting field. And rho will be a map from the Galois group into the group of automorphisms that tells how the group is constructed by telling me how the Galois group is acting on the set of characters. So this will be a homomorphism with finite image. And then we can ask what conditions have to be satisfied for a given torus to be isomorphic to a Cartan subgroup in one of these two groups. So let me just state a criterion here. State this. In fact, T is isomorphic over F in a way that preserves characters and co-characters in the two different situations. With a Cartan subgroup in G, if, well, what needs to hold? First of all, the image of rho is going to have to be related to the root system of G, and we'll just say that it needs to come from the viel group of that root system. But also, we can allow this automorphism sigma, so I can form a semi-direct product and ask for the image of rho to lie inside this group of automorphisms. And then there's an additional condition caused by the fact that this automorphism is coming from the Frobenius automorphism of an unramified extension. And so that can be stated as let's extend this to the algebraic closure, say. And if tau maps to the Frobenius in the maximal unramified extension, then I'll write rho of tau is going to have to map to this element sigma. And there's a nice corollary that we see immediately from this fact, and that is, if you recall, this is just a subset of this, and this sigma H was constructed by taking this sigma and composing it with some element of the viel group of this root system. And so if something if I have a T that is a Cartan subgroup for the group H, well, that's a more restrictive condition than to be a Cartan subgroup for the group G. So what that means is that any Cartan subgroup inside H automatically transfers over to a Cartan subgroup of G. Let me write this down. What is the question? Well, yes. Yeah, so I erase this. I want this condition right here. Yes, G splits over an unramified extension of F. Yes, I'm taking a Cartan subgroup defined over F. I mean, G will, I'm not sure I understand the question. G will have a lot of different Cartan subgroups. One Cartan subgroup or one class of Cartan subgroups will be split over F, but there will be many others as well. And I'm talking about all of these different Cartan subgroups now. In the last lecture, we talked about the one specific Cartan subgroup that's split over an unramified extension. Yeah, so this is going to be if and only. So we have an isomorphism of every Cartan subgroup of H with 1 over G, and this is going to be an isomorphism over F, and it's going to be one that preserves first two ingredients of the classification data. Now this is not a uniquely determined Cartan subgroup, and this leads immediately to the issue of conjugacy and stable conjugacy. So let me spend a few minutes describing those issues. So if I have G and G prime and G of F, and let's assume that they're regular semi-simple elements, of course, conjugacy means that I can conjugate one to the other. By some element in the group, but it can very well happen that the two elements are inside the group over the ground field, and they could very well be conjugate by an element that is not in the ground field, but in some field extension, say over the algebraic closure. And in this case, we say that the elements are stably conjugate rather than just conjugate. And again, this is an equivalence relation on the elements. Simple example, take SL2, QP. I can take an element of the form AB, PB, A. It will be an SL2 if A squared minus PB squared is equal to 1. I can take an element of the form A, B, PB, and A. And we can conjugate one element to the other just by taking a square root of P. But the square root of P is not an element in QP, it's an element in a quadratic extension. So for these two elements to be brought one to the other, we need to use something in an extension. That means that these elements are stably conjugate. It cannot be done in the ground field, so they're not conjugate. Now, whenever this is the case, we can take... Well, I'll leave this as an exercise, but in this case, it cannot be done. If I take an element of the Galois group and apply it to this relation, and if I use the fact that both of the elements that I start with are in the ground field, I get that this is just gamma prime again. And this is an automorphism, and so I get tau G inverse tau of gamma tau of G, and this is in the ground field as well. So what I get is this relation, which can be rewritten. Say that tau G inverse. Well, if I move this G inverse over here, what I find is that I get an element that centralizes this element gamma. So I get an element centralizer in G of gamma. If I have a regular semi-simple element, this is going to give a Cartan subgroup. And I get such an element as this. Let A tau be this element. What you find is it satisfies co-cycle relation, which is straightforward to verify. And that means that we get an element in a cohomology group, Galois F bar over F, with coefficients in the Cartan subgroup T. So whenever two elements are stably conjugate but not conjugate, there's a class in a cohomology that measures how far those classes are from being conjugate. Now, nice thing about this cohomology group is that it's been computed by what's called the Take-Nakayama isomorphism. So we can say explicitly what it is that's measuring stable conjugacy. For those wanting a reference, look this up in Serre's local fields. So, the result is this cohomology group is given by elements U in the character group such that the character has norm 1. So I take a splitting field of the element and look at elements such that when I sum the action of the Galois group over that particular element, I get 0. And I take that modulo elements such that there exists a tau and a v such that u equals tau v minus V. So tau is an element here of the Galois group, and V is a co-character. Okay, so that's the computation of this cohomology group. Let me do a simple example. Let's take the one-dimensional torus that we looked at in the lecture yesterday. This is a one-dimensional torus that is not split, but it splits by a quadratic extension. we looked at the characters and co-characters in the last lecture. This was just free group rank 1. We identify it with Z. The fact that this is non-split means that the action of the Galois group on the co-characters here is non-trivial. And there's really only one non-trivial action here, and that is negation. So tau, the non-trivial element here, sends V to minus V. So let's look at this. The numerator on the right-hand side is the set of co-characters that have norm 0, but this is just going to be U plus minus U equals 0. So in this case, everything has norm 0 because our norm is adding a vector with its negation. And the condition here, again, tau is going to be negation. And so I'll get minus V minus V minus 2V in the denominator. So the numerator is all of Z, and the denominator is 2Z, so this cohomology group has two elements by the Tait-Nakayama isomorphism. The group that we looked at yesterday was E unramified, but this calculation works even when extension is ramified. Now, if I start with a Cartan subgroup that's inside H, and then use what I did at the beginning of the lecture to identify TH with an isomorphic Cartan subgroup in G, then I can take an element here and produce some sort of corresponding element here and look at its cohomology. If we think a minute about the defining data for H, this was defined by a couple of choices. One was an element S that we used to pick out the smaller set of coroots, and another was a vial group element that we used to define a new element sigma. But what was this element S? Was from yesterday. And notice that the numerator here in this calculation of the cohomology group is actually a subgroup of what I have here. So if I take this S, I can apply it to the numerator in this expression here to get a number. So S applied to the cocycle, a tau gives what I'll call kappa A tau, which is an element of C star. And I won't check this here, but the fact that we start out with a Cartan subgroup in H and then move it over to G allows you to do a little calculation to check that it's actually well-defined on the quotient, and you get an element kappa A tau that depends only on the cohomology class and not on the particular representation A tau. So I get a kappa from H1. I'll just write this as H1. Character. So this A tau is well, this is for any G. Okay, so whenever I have an element stably conjugate to one that I start out with, there will be a corresponding cocycle and a corresponding complex number that I can attach to it using the endoscopic group. Okay, so I think we're ready to state fundamental lemma at last. So I'll start with H unramified endoscopic group. G, let's take TH, a Cartan, and I'll say transfer it to TG in G, and I'm going to have more to say about this later. The fact that there's not a unique way of doing this is going to cause some rather major headaches, and I'm just going to ignore those for a few minutes, but I'll come back to those headaches later. We talked about a special maximal compact subgroup in the group G last time, one called hyperspecial. And I can do the same thing in the endoscopic group. I'll write chi of k, chi kh for the characteristic functions. And I'm going to write down the most complicated expression of any of my lectures. Let's write it this way. Let's take gamma in TH. And let's take gamma 0 to be the corresponding element inside this isomorphic torus over in G. And then I'll use notation like gamma prime for a stable conjugate. And I'll just write a tau for the corresponding co-cycle. Then I sum over all gamma prime stably conjugate to this gamma zero up to conjugacy. So if two elements are conjugate, I don't want separate terms in the sum. I just want those that are stably conjugate but not conjugate. And then an integral of the characteristic function of K over this element gamma prime. Then I have a complex number that I get by taking this character of the first cohomology group, A tau. And that's basically the integral I want to consider. But I want to add in a few normalizing factors. The first normalizing factor, this is going to depend, of course, the integral here is over GF, and elements in the centralizer, well, they don't have any influence, so I'm going to mod out by such elements. And so I hope the notation is clear. This one's a kappa, this one is a K. This is going to depend on a choice of Haar measure on the group G. I want to use an invariant measure here and on a choice of an invariant measure here. And to eliminate the effect of that measure, I'm just going to divide by the volume of K with respect to this measure dg. Maybe I should write dg dot to show that it's a quotient measure. And that way, if I rescale the Haar measure by a scalar factor, the denominator is going to be rescaled by the same factor, and the two cancel, and so I get something that's independent of the Haar measure on g. And I'll do the same in the numerator to eliminate the influence of the measure chosen on the centralizer. I'll take the volume with respect to dt of a maximal compact subgroup here. So I'll just call this K of the centralizer. I ask you to remember that's the maximal compact subgroup here. There's one more thing I want to do to make this integral nice to work with, and that is that this, if you look at this as I vary gamma prime, for instance, as gamma prime is heading towards the identity element, well, what happens when this, if I just put 1 in for this integral? Well, every, and ignoring the denominator here, I would get a diverging integral because it would just, and every element would commute with 1, and so it would always be inside the characteristic function of this maximal compact. I'd be integrating over the full group and it would diverge. And so to keep things bounded, I'm just going to add a factor. I'll write as alpha gamma 0 minus 1 the 1/2 exponent alpha ranging over the roots of G. So this is a factor that Harishchandra used to keep integrals, orbital integrals as they're called, bounded. Okay, so hope you can read this expression. Let me just rewrite it. Alpha gamma 0 minus 1, absolute value of 1/2, and I run over all the roots. Okay, but the main part of the integral is this orbital integral right here, summed over all the stable conjugates. This integral is called a kappa orbital integral just because of the notation that's used. There's this kappa in the notation coming from the character. I've done this for the group G. I can do the same thing for the group H. And I'll write the integral for H with this notation, again, picking an element gamma. So I just make the substitution. I write the same expression, but with k going to kh, g being replaced by h, the roots of g being replaced by roots of h, the Hard measure on g by the Hard measure on h, stable conjugacy in g by stable conjugacy in h. The only thing I need to explain is this. Kappa now becomes constant function 1. So on the one side, we have what's called a kappa orbital integral. On the other, yes? Yes? The dependence on H is through this kappa. So does what? No, so this is a weird thing. Gamma, this is an integral on G indexed by an element of H. Okay, and the connection is this isomorphism that we've picked between this Cartan subgroup on H and the one on G. Okay, so it's a funny thing. It's an integral on one group indexed by a parameter on another. So more later. I mean, there's the problem with the choice is wrapped up in this one sentence, in this one comment in parentheses. What is the question again?
Well, the stably conjugate is in G, right? Gamma prime.
Yes, this is in G.
And
well, so H was defined by an element S.
Right.
And the element S is used to define the character kappa.
Right.
Okay, and that's it. That's right. That's right. I've put an H in the notation here, but it's. I could write it. Maybe if you prefer, write it with an S here.
Okay, so it doesn't really depend.
It just barely. I mean it. Yes. So I want to write the parameter as gamma in both cases. Okay. So gamma prime in here will be, yes, so gamma prime is now stably conjugate to gamma. Okay, and I won't write out this full expression again. I think these substitutions are sufficiently clear to see what this should be. Then the conjecture fundamental lemma is that this is equal to this. All gamma regular semi-simple in H such that the corresponding gamma zero is also regular semi-simple over NG. Okay, I mean, it is a technical point, but it could happen that something is regular in H, but then when you move it over to the other group, it becomes somehow singular. Okay, so that's the conjecture. As I mentioned in the first lecture, it's proved. For SLN, by Walsh-Berger, and it's what I would consider close to being proved by Lamont for the group, unitary group. So this is in a couple of different preprints. It's close to done because it assumes what is called a purity conjecture that I won't go into. It was made by Goreski, Kotwicz, and McPherson. I'm going to give an example of such an explicit map in just a few minutes. So where does this come up? Why? Okay, this is a crazy identity of integrals. All this talk about the fundamental lemma, and then you see it, and of course you wonder what's the point. So this comes up. First of all, in the stable, in the trace formula. So trace formula, this is a big simplification. So let me just say a word about why. So the trace formula is a formula between traces of representations viewed as distributions and complicated identities involving orbital integrals, right? All sorts of messy sums on both sides. I won't go into the details. Now, for a lot of the applications of the trace formula, for instance, to Langlands' principle of functoriality, you're trying to compare representations on one group with representations on another. The Langlands' principle of functoriality predicts relationships between representations on different groups. And the idea is to show relationships between representations by using this formula and showing identities between orbital integrals. Okay, so, and to carry out these comparisons, a few cases have been worked out, and it helps to group together the terms in the trace formula that come from the same stable conjugacy class. Putting things together when they're related over the algebraic closure allows you to give a more geometric treatment of the terms and makes it easier to compare terms in the trace formula. And so for that, you want to rearrange terms, for instance, such as this, where things are not stable because I have this kappa, this character, coming up into something that is stable. And that's exactly what the fundamental lemma is asserting, that when I take some, so any orbital integral can be expanded just by taking all the characters on this finite abelian cohomology group. Any orbital integral can be expanded into kappa orbital integrals. And then if you believe the fundamental lemma, any kappa orbital integral can be rewritten as a stable orbital integral, not on the group G, but on these closely related groups that are called the endoscopic groups. Okay, so that, in a few words, is the motivation behind. When you start studying things like the cohomology of Shimura varieties, you see that the endoscopic groups come up in a very natural way in the description of the zeta functions of these things, for instance. And this can all be traced back to identities such as this at the level of orbital integrals. Now, potentially, yes. So I've written this as an integral. In the next lecture, we're going to start talking about geometric interpretations. The first way you might try to prove this identity is just, well, we have two integrals. Let's compute the two integrals and see if the two integrals are the same. That turns out to be, these integrals turn out to be extremely difficult to compute. And people have found over the last 20 years that the hope, the real hope of proving this in general, is finding a geometric interpretation of these integrals and then using the geometry to prove the identity. So I've written things the way that the trace formula people want to see it proved, but people working on the problem actually think of things very geometrically. Okay, so let me give you first reduction. Okay, let me do a simple case first. If gamma and gamma zero are not in any compact subgroup, they're not conjugate to anything in a compact. Well, this is a characteristic function of a compact subgroup. And so these elements and their conjugates are not in any compact subgroup, then both sides of the equality are zero, and we've proved the identity. Okay. Okay, not so bad. So let's look at elements that lie in a compact subgroup. Say gamma in this Carton. Let's assume gamma is in a compact subgroup. For such elements, there's a decomposition of gamma called the topological Jordan decomposition. I can write gamma as a commuting product of two elements that I'll call S and U. S will be an element of finite order. And that order is I think I'll keep the S. We're pretty much through with the other S for now. So S is an element of finite order. U is what's called topologically unipotent. It's an element such that when I take its powers p to the n, it converges to a limit as I take n to infinity. In fact, I just get 1. So a special case of this is discussed, for instance, if you want a reference, in Iwasawa's local class field theory. And that is just the multiplicative group, then the elements that are in a compact subgroup are just the units of the multiplicative field. So here, GMF is just F star, and this special case is treated by Iwasawa. And in this case, what we want, well, what he gives is the definition. In this case, he checks that this limit converges, and, well, I guess I really want Q to the n, where Q is the number of elements in the residue field. This element S is known to algebraic number theory people as the Teichmuller character, the Teichmuller representative of the element. Let me state this reduction. And then I'll be done for the day. So I can let G of S be the centralizer in G of S, H of S centralizer in H of S, and this, what you find is that if I take this strange identity of orbital integrals, that there is a descent that allows me to pass to the smaller reductive group that I get by taking the centralizer of this element of finite order. And I get just an identity like this. Now, descent is proved by Langlands and Schellstadt in a rather technical paper. There are two parts to this. One is to show that the orbital integrals are well behaved with respect to these two different groups. And the other is to show that this kappa term is well behaved with respect to the two different groups. And you might suspect that the analytic part of checking the integrals would be the hard part of the proof, but actually that's the easy part. And it's a long technical argument to show that the kappa that appears, this little cohomological term that appears in the identity, is compatible as I move from one group to the other. And so that's a technical result, not so easy to prove because of this technicality, but this is true nevertheless. And the same is true on the other side of the identity. If P, the residual characteristic, is large, there is a good exponential map that has all topologically unipotent elements in the image. And this allows me to write U as an exponential. And the rest of the reduction, Volz-Berger, has proved deep homogeneity results. Let's say, basically, if I take this integral and look at it, say, along a curve, I get just a polynomial in the absolute value of lambda. Now, this is homogeneity in the same sense of De Backer's lectures, that we have a lot of distributions on the left, and we're just relating it to a small number of distributions on the right. This is a polynomial, so I only have finitely many coefficients. So this is a finiteness result. And homogeneity is a strange word to be using, but historically, this is where it first came up, and it was referring to the individual terms of this identity, and each individual term of a polynomial is homogeneous, and that's where it comes up. And you can do the same thing on the other side. This is just, you just prove these results for classical groups. So H, S, X, and R squared X, BI. And I. And if you want to prove an equality here, well, two polynomials are equal if they're equal for lambda sufficiently small. And so this was the strategy of at least this reduction of the fundamental lemma. You prove it for things really close to the origin, and then you use homogeneity to scale it out and prove it for all of the topologically unipotent elements. And by this earlier reduction, that proves the fundamental lemma. Okay, so that was the strategy. And so we get equality. if equality holds for lambda sufficiently small. And what you're able to do in this way is transport the fundamental lemma to a statement about, from a statement about groups to a statement about Lie algebras, because you're rescaling everything in towards the identity element of the group. And that's the reduction.